Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. I'm Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best book name Watchmen. So that's just how we're going to do it moving forward on Cop Out episodes. To help me find this needle in the haystack are my two very good friends, Ian and Joe, two high school English teachers.
My name is Joe Holshue. I'm a high school English teacher. And Nick, today I have ascended. I have separated myself from time. I see all time as one continuum. Wow. And I recommend the 1987 book, which seems like it's happening right now, Watchmen by Alan Moore.
I'm Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a high school English teacher. And today, Nick, I'm wondering, quis custodiet ipsos custodes? Who watches the Watchmen? I brought Ian Rankin's 1988 novel, Watchmen, because I misunderstood the conceit. Yeah, this is a real problem.
Oh, shoot. I just brought a copy of the movie. I have it in front of me. I'm not sure what we're supposed to do.
I also brought the groundbreaking, wonderful, and perhaps I'm going to argue a bit past its prime.
Wow.
Graphic novel, Watchmen, Alan Moore, Dave Gibbons.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Dave Gibbons. The artist.
Dave Gibbons. This is the part of the podcast where we say the name Dave Gibbons in a sort of summoning way, and we hope he appears in our studios.
Dave has not yet, would you please Dave say Gibbons. Dave Gibbons? And now we have said it three times, and we will wait.
Yep.
You guys are looking at the copy of the book, right? Otherwise, it won't happen.
Oh, shoot. I'm looking at the end. Sorry.
It's just like looking at a mirror.
Dave Gibbons?
Dave Gibbons.
Cool. So who do you think this episode is for? Because I was thinking about that today. I'm thinking, well, if it's people that love graphic novels, and they've definitely read this. Well, and if it's people that don't, how are you going to convince them?
Are you trying to ask the question, who are we alienating this week?
Yeah, who are we alienating? Is it everyone?
I think it's no one. I think this is universally beloved. And I think if you've never read a graphic novel, I think this is a great entry point. I also think I'm trying to think back, Ian. I think this is the first graphic novel I'd ever read.
Was it the last?
No, I've read, I wouldn't say many since. I've read some.
He's read one. And it was Persepolis.
He just reread this.
He hated it. I would say, yeah, it's got to be up there. I think so.
Do you think you guys are going to bring it when it comes to maybe some of the people who are already pretty familiar with this and its lure? And that was not L-U-R-E. That was like lore.
Oh.
How do you spell lore?
L-O-H-R.
H-R-O. Silent E.
O-R. Lure.
Do you think people that really know this are, you think you're going to bring something to the table there?
I think, I don't know. This is huge, and I feel kind of like you're coming at us a bit there, Nick, but yes, I think so. I think this is a novel which lives differently in the minds of its different readers. It has a different life depending on who you are, depending on kind of your experiences and your views of the world. We've talked in the last couple of weeks a lot, weirdly, about kind of how we view the world. We had a conversation about, like, are people naturally good or naturally bad? And I think this novel kind of acts like a mirror for the reader. And so my mirror image that I see myself in this novel, and it's different, I think, probably from how Joe sees himself in this novel.
Oh, right. Yeah. I think that's probably true. I also think that
I see myself as the naked guy with the huge dong.
But as the blue Mr. one. Big Blue Dong. Dr. Big Blue Dong to you.
Did you know he's actually a self-insert for Nick Argyris?
I feel like Dr. Ian DeYoung is very like melodically in sync with Dr. Big Blue Dong.
Wow. Hurtful.
What yes. the
I'm going to get us off. I'm going to get us off this track. This is a useless track.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
Speaking of tracks, I'm ready. I'm ready for the track, the background track.
Oh, fantastic.
Okay.
Watchman. It's all about the clocks, man. Hatton was a watchmaker, but not really a risk taker. The doomsday clocks tick lower and lower and lower. The sower of fear, pain, and tears. A huge fake squid becomes one man's bid to bring peace. I hid what I had to. I hid all my tracks through a complex series of shell companies and third parties. Yeah, wealth is the best if you never second-guess the decisions you make, the right turns you take. If you use plenty of fake-outs and misdirections, use your clout to shape the world in the way that you want. I mean, sure, there's a body count, but omelets need making. If you want to have the cake of world peace and eat it too, you've got to push through the guilt and the horror. Nothing ever ends. We'll see you tomorrow.
Absolutely. Yep, just fantastic. These are so...
easy to find a beat for. So easy to find a beat for, I would imagine.
Digestible. Thank you, Ian. As always, we love your wrappings. So thank you for bringing that. I think that pretty much will wrap up the episode.
That's why people are here.
That's why people come.
To experience the sheer mental torture of listening to Ian rap. I really appreciate all the support. You guys are my best.
Yeah, well, this is where you should come for support. That's for sure.
You just keep me positive. You keep me looking up. I appreciate it so much.
Are we going to talk about how we happen to be posting this episode on November 2nd?
I think we should talk about it. Ian?
Yeah, so I actually started...
Do you think this episode is fate? Why don't you explain why this episode is fate, Ian?
I reread this book for today's episode in preparation, and I opened it on October 12th, and I looked at the first words. The first words are Rorschach's journal, October 12th, 1985. And it was just like, I had like one of these little mental moments. And I think when we run across dates, yeah, significant dates, and when we're reading a book, this book is a book which, as I've already mentioned, has a way of kind of getting inside your head, making you question the extent to which like the stuff that you're reading is it's an alternative history. But you see things which could mimic our history. And the fact that as I was finishing reading this, I was realizing we're posting this episode on November 2nd, which is the day that the climactic events in this novel take place. And the fact that we're posting this on the day that...
See, I think it's destiny.
No, Redheads, happy doomsday. Happy doomsday, Litheads.
Happy doomsday. Now, you mentioned
happy
alternate,
Litheads.
Alternate universe. Are you saying that superheroes don't exist?
Alternate history and the real superheroes, Nick. I don't know if you've been watching the news, but the real superheroes are fire persons and nurses, first responders.
Yes, so essential workers.
When we had our daughter, we went to the hospital, and one of the signs out in front it said "Heroes work here," and some rapscallions changed some of the letters to say "hoes work here."
No,
and I just want you to hear that, so every time you see a "heroes work here" sign, you think of "hoes work here." Yeah, I want that to be in your head too.
Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it.
So guys, why don't you tell me what this book is about in 30 seconds? Who's in charge?
In unison?
Let's both read our separately prepared prepared 30 second summaries in unison.
Speaking of everything clicking, I think we could do both of them, and then Nick, you can tell us who's better. This is how we win this week.
Oh, two
like
winners.
That. Two winners.
But more importantly, two losers. So I love it. So let's go for it.
I'd like to start.
Yeah, of course. Joe, can you please start us?
Nick, Watchmen is the best comic book ever written, and don't take my word for it. Trust Time Magazine, who ranked it as the only one on its list of the 100 best novels of all time. Alan Moore, its writer, is a pretty accomplished guy himself. He's been called the Orson Welles of comics, the undisputed high priest of the medium, and a man whose every word is seized upon like a message from the ether. A prominent comics historian says to call Alan Moore the best writing in the history of comics is an understatement. Oh, he's also an occultist, a ceremonial magician, and an anarchist.
Hold on.
Nick is writing down the name Alan Moore for his next child.
That's pretty compelling, Joe. Do you want to try one, Ian?
Sure.
Are you good with just, do you have any raps for us?
No.
No more. Just the one.
Just the one.
Just the one. I think you should I think you should submit your rap as your entry into this contest.
Okay. I hereby do that.
Congratulations, do that, Ian. That was a really good rap. You won.
Thank you. The playing field was level. The goalposts are not moving. And I accept this victory.
Mm-hmm. Step it up, Joe.
So I just took my headphones off because I had to take off my sweater. I was very warm and I didn't hear any of the last like 20 seconds.
Oh. I said you won. So good job.
Thank you so
much. Hold on, Ian. Can you take off your headphones for a second?
Sure. Taking off my headphones.
Right. Joe, congratulations. You did win. Good work.
Fantastic. Excellent. It's about
time.
Good
work. That's positive reinforcement.
Do I have to? I have a lot of other notes here. Should I go through those before I win, or is this good?
No. You won the 30-second plot.
Oh,
game. Fantastic. Yeah.
Good.
Ian.
Suck it, Ian.
Are you there? Put your headphones back on if you can hear me. So, boy, I want to hear more about Alan Moore. That's all I want to hear about. Joe.
Yeah.
Can you tell me some things about Sir Alan Moore?
Okay. So I can tell you some things about Sir Alan Moore. Is he? I don't think he's Sir Alan Moore.
Nope.
Yep.
Nick's trying to give him all kinds of tests.
All sorts of honorary.
That was a test.
I can tell you a handful of things about Alan Moore. He is obviously a comics writer, and he says comics, not graphic novels, much like our friend who wrote Persepolis, whose name is, of course, Ian.
Marjan Satrapi.
Thank you. But like Marjan Satrapi, how'd I do?
Good job.
Thank you. He says he doesn't write graphic novels. He writes comics.
Hey, Joe, sorry to interrupt. Pretty good at it. Can you just go ahead and take up a pronunciation point there?
Yeah, thank you. I will tally it down right next to our show rules. Nick, do we want to talk about our show rules?
Oh, that's right. Dang it. That's especially important in this episode. Holy cow.
Yeah. Thanks for keeping us on track there, Joe. We do appreciate that. Yes, our show rules, of course. Only unavoidable spoilers. Omit needless words, Joe. And winning isn't everything. It's the only thing, as Joe is obviously proven by his... Sorry, Ian, can you take off your headphones again?
Yep, taking off those headphones, and they're off.
All right, and, by Joe's wonderful win. All right, and get Thank those you. Headphones
Fantastic.
Back on, Ian.
Excellent.
Put them back on just in time.
And Joe, can you take... Okay, now we're done.
Okay, so Alan Moore was an accomplished comic book writer. He's been an accomplished comic book writer for a long time. If you take a look at his list of awards, he wins the Eisner Award pretty much every year that he writes something. Like if Alan Moore is in the field, everybody else is tallied up in the column of also ran.
What's the Eisner Award?
The Eisner Award is, of course, Nick, the most prominent award in all of comics. I made that up. I think that's probably true.
Okay. It's named after William Will Eisner. He was a very influential. It's kind of like a Hugo Award or a Nebula Award.
Okay, and what are
genre,
those?
It's a genre award.
Tony, you know what a Hugo Award is and a Nebula because our friend Orson Scott Card won them both in the same year.
Back to back, he won them. Yep. Nick, I would appreciate if you would pay attention to the things that Ian and I prepare.
Let's just move on, guys. Let's just move on.
On Alan Moore's 40th birthday, he was celebrating with many of his friends. They were taking some psychedelics. He talks about taking mushrooms that night. And kind of in a peak, at his peak of the evening, he declared in this long speech to his friends that he is going to pursue wizardry and he intends to become a magician. He woke up the next day and thought, oh shit, I just told all my friends I'm going to be a wizard. So he started researching how to do it, and he's gotten like pretty into it. He has, much of his work has gravitated in that direction. He has He has led circles and things like that to usher in the end of the world. And this is the weird thing. This is like maybe the weirdest thing about Alan Moore. Like that stuff all sounds crazy. Like that stuff all sounds absolutely nuts. But the weirdest thing about him is every interview that you watch with him, he comes across as just a like kind of a grumpy and kind of eccentric, but an incredibly intelligent, well-spoken, reasonable human. And I think that contrast is so interesting at the heart of Alan Moore.
Well, he's with the wizardry stuff. I read some stuff. I did a little bit of research on him, not as much as Joe seems to have done, but there's a degree to which he says like, no, I 100% believe this. And there's also a degree to which he's like, no, this is complete bullpucky. Like he's not. So he has Joe, are you going to get into his patron deity at all?
Nope.
He has a snake god that is his primary homeboy. Mm-hmm. And he's like, yeah, I know this his god words? Doesn't. What?
His words.
No, this is my editorializing. But oh, okay. he's like, yeah, I know this god doesn't really exist, but the point is the fiction, and fiction has this power. And so he's kind of wrapped it into, it's really hard to say like how much he believes and how much he's like, I seriously, earnestly believe I'm going to bring about the end of the world or whatever. There's also a degree to which he's like using it to make a point about the power of imagination and storytelling and performance. And yeah,
is he just fucking with us? Like,
okay. So I think that's a really interesting question, because the answer is,
I think he's fucking
maybe
with us.
It's kind of hard to tell. It's hard to tell. I will say that when you listen to Alan Moore speak, I don't know if he sees himself as this, but I think he is a modern day philosopher. Like he is somebody who has just stepped back from his daily life. Who like, I try to think, I always get the impression that he has zoomed out from like the petty trials of day to day life. And he really thinks about like the world and life on a much grander scale, on a cosmic scale, on a big scale.
On a really rich, successful
person. The wealth is interesting.
The wealth is interesting. Go ahead, Ian.
No, go ahead. You've probably got more about this than I do.
No, the only thing I was going to say about wealth is Alan Moore is famously grumpy when it comes to adapting any of his work to really anything besides its original form, right?
And we might say mostly crotchety or prickly. Yeah.
I like that. Both he's all of those things. He has, to whatever extent it is in his power, totally stopped any Hollywood adaptations of his work, which of course is crazy because we've seen lots of Hollywood adaptations of his work. He's failed
miserably.
Watchmen. We've seen V for Vendetta. We've seen all sorts of things like this, which are of course things that he just doesn't own the rights to. In some cases, when he does still have rights to it, and he is, and what he will do is he will basically he'll sign off on the adaptation being made, but say, I want nothing to do with it. Please send all the royalties to my collaborator on this, who would be the artist. So Alan Moore, for years, has forgone any royalties from any of his work being adapted, any that he was entitled to essentially maintain the high ground.
And as we all know, that artist is Dave Gibbons. Dave Gibbons. Dave Gibbons.
In the case of Watchmen, yes. Dave Gibbons. Dave Gibbons. Dave Gibbons.
He's here. Hi, Dave.
Oh, Jesus.
Hi, Dave. We'd like to invite our special guest on this episode, Dave Gibbons. Dave Gibbons. Dave Gibbons is here.
Hello, it's me. Hello, it's me, Dave Gibbons.
Oh,
how can I help you guys today? I'm English, but I don't sound like it. I sound like just a croaky voice fella. Isn't that true? So what can I tell you about Watchmen?
Dave, thank you for the
process of writing it.
Taking the time from cashing those sweet checks to join us today. That must be a full-time job.
I tell you, my fingers are blistered. I cash the checks. I write the signature so much, my fingers get blistered. It's dreadful.
Yeah, that must be tough as an illustrator.
Well, and I mostly illustrate with my toes now because the fingers are so, you know... Some of my fans say that's why my work has gone downhill in terms of quality and control. But, you know, I'm getting there. And also, I'm rich, so who cares what they think?
Yeah. So, Dave Gibbons, Dave Gibbons, Dave Gibbons, how long have you been drawing with your toes?
It's been about the last 15, 20 years. I really started to hit it big. And you know, the Watchmen movie, a lot of people didn't like it, but it was pretty successful for me because I got a lot of money from it. So that's how I count success.
Did you guys watch the HBO show?
I did. Not. Thank you for asking. I was. My name was on it. You could see my name on that.
Sorry. Hey, Dave Gibbons.
I'm gonna
let you go.
I think someone else is summoning you, Dave.
I was kind of talking to Ian.
Oh yeah, he's right here.
If you could just.
Okay. Nice to talk to you guys. Yeah. No. Talk to you later sometime. Okay.
Thanks, Dave.
See ya.
Yeah, he was like pushing me away from the microphone.
He only wants to talk about his feet these days.
Yeah, I think he may be like friends with Quentin Tarantino or something like that. I don't know.
What do you mean?
Not going to get into it. What was the question? Oh yeah. What's this book about? It's a murder mystery.
No, it isn't.
It is.
Hey Joe, what's this book about?
I also only have one line. My synopsis says God exists and he's American.
Mm, I love it. Did you write that?
That's also good.
I did. I wrote that. Yes. Thank you.
I love it.
No, you did not.
I wrote it. Fuck you, Ian.
There's another mystery. Will Joe get away with the plagiarism?
All this wizard talk has got me hungry for a Hobbit fact. Do you like how I introduce your segment?
Sure,
like you read my one-star reviews?
I love that. You know what? Dr. Manhattan, who is colloquially referred to as God in that quote that Joe shamelessly lifted from the text of this book, Dr. Manhattan has godlike powers. You know who else does? Gandalf the Grey. Mm. And here's your Hobbit fact for the day. There are five wizards in the Tolkien legendarium. Just five. It's not like a Wizard of Earthsea where you can just train a new wizard. No, there were five and that's it. And when they're dead, that's kind of the end of them. And
wait,
the five
there were no more than those five?
That's it. The whole literal thousands of years. So there were five. Wow. There was Gandalf. There was Saruman. There was Radagast the Brown, who we see a shameful caricature of in the Peter Jackson Hobbit films.
Just humiliating.
Among all the other characters as well.
There were two other wizards in the Lord of the Rings, like legendarium, who were blue wizards. So they all have colors. You've got Gandalf the Grey, you've got Saruman the White, you've got Radagast the Brown, and then you've got two blizzards.
And there's a hierarchy to wizards.
Two blue wizards. One of them is named Alatar, and the other name is named Palando. And that's all we know about them.
Isn't there a hierarchy to the colors? Like, we see Gandalf ascend from the gray to the white, obviously. But, like, is blue, is that lower than gray? Is brown? Like, what's the color code?
The sense is just that, like, they're all under Saruman. Saruman's the big boy, and then everybody else is kind of around the same level. But, yeah, there's not a complicated... It's a really strange thing that Tolkien decided to put in, and I still don't understand why. Unless it's part of that... Like, what he does is he puts in all these little details to flesh out the world. And he maybe thought he would come back to them, but he never did.
Mm. Only five.
So that's like all we know about the wizards is that there's five and they have colors.
In the unfinished tales, it turns out that all five of the wizards, they're called Istari. All five of them come to Middle Earth together and they have a mission. The blue wizards head off for their mission. And it's possible that they failed, but we really don't know about them.
Hmm.
So. That has been your Hobbit fact for the day. You're welcome. Oh, blue. They're blue like Dr. Manhattan. Oh, I didn't make that connection.
Alan Moore looks like a wizard. He's got a big beard. Sure does. Big long ponytail. Looks like a wizard.
Well, that was the segue into doing this segment.
Yeah. Well, that's the segue out as well.
Boy, we just increased our efficiency, didn't we? Same segues in as out.
That's right.
You could reverse that segment and it would work exactly the same amount of good, which is not very.
I don't like that. Yep.
This is great. Thank you, guys.
So, guys, as we've worked through these hundreds of episodes so far, it's been really fascinating for me, at least, to get to know little factoids about you people, about your lives, about the things that shaped you. Specifically, Joe, about the pus that shaped
our names.
You. But other pus and other situations. And this puts me in mind of the fact that there is a whole genre
of works that do this.
There are?
People's life stories. So.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Yeah, they're called first-person shooters, and it's a style of video game, which is all
first-person shooting. Yeah, it's about shooting from the first-person point of view. But no, there is like, I really like, I think what you're talking about, Ian, is biographies here, right? Yes.
Oh, they're also known as biographies. Yeah, first-person shooter and biography.
Yeah, and I really like the idea of like telling somebody's story through like these little anecdotes about them, or through like telling the, I guess, like the day-to-day minutia of their lives.
Yeah, the sort of street level view. I've got a biography I could bring. I could bring a biography which used to be a novel. I'll talk about it next week. But the biography is called Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. And despite the fact that it's about slavery, it's got kind of a hopeful, like a rising arc. Because here's a spoiler.
Oh.
She does get free at the end, which is nice.
Seems like an unnecessary spoiler.
I guess that is... I think it's very unavoidable. So I'm going to bring Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl by Harriet Jacobs.
I am going to bring, plain speaking, the oral biography of Harry S. Truman. Fun fact, the S doesn't stand for anything. It's just an initial.
Wow. Can we expect incredible little bits like that on next week's episode? If you
liked that, you'll love next week.
You know when a biography's title includes the word plane and not in the term of aeroplane, you know it's gonna pop off.
It sounds like next week's gonna be really fun, guys.
Join us for our final episode next week. Okay, do you want to maybe muddle through the plot a little bit, or get a sense of the overarching story?
Yeah, what happens in this? So it's about a bunch of watchmakers, right?
There's a murder mystery.
It is a murder mystery.
Is it?
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say the very first thing we
go
see
ahead,
happen.
Joe.
Yep, thank you, everybody. The very first thing that we see happen in Watchmen.
Ahead, Joe. This is me, Dave Gibbons again, and I'm telling you, go ahead.
Dude, sorry. I muted my mic and said Dave Gibbons 3 times again, guys. That was my bad.
You just popped back up here. I don't know why you summon him and he comes to my house in Nevada, but.
So weird.
I guess we'll never know. Anyway, we'll never Joe, go know. Ahead.
So the very first thing that happens in Watchmen is a...
Hey, okay, Joe, go ahead.
A superhero or a hero or a former hero, or I guess a current government contractor, superhero turned government contractor named the Comedian, is murdered. He's thrown out of his apartment window. Falls many stories to the ground and is dead. One of our other characters, Rorschach, named after, of course, the famous test, in which you are shown ink blots and you are supposed to see what you see in them. He suspects that foul play is afoot, seeing as, you know, the Comedian got thrown out of a window. The main plot that drives it is Rorschach and the kind of former members of the Watchmen, which was this superhero group that has since been disbanded, are trying to get to the bottom of this. Or I guess they aren't all trying to get to the bottom of it. They all take it kind of as various levels of seriousness.
This is a lot already.
It's
this
a lot
seems
already.
Like a lot to explain. Now, there are quite a few characters. Full disclosure, I've watched the movie, I've watched the HBO series, and I have perused through this graphic novel, which is what I call it. Huh. So,
I think you're mispronouncing it. It's pronounced graphic novel.
Oh, sorry. I got a little cold. I can't do that. I don't know where I was going with that besides
characters.
I guess how many characters?
Seems
do you
like there's
talk
a lot
about?
Of characters
there's like,
to
there's
get
like
through.
There's like 4 or 5 characters of note, I would say.
Well, but okay, but the thing is, I think
is that true?
Yeah. So like the reason, Nick, you're saying there's a lot of characters in Jay, you're like there's 4 or 5 main characters. There's so much going on in this story, both in terms of flashbacks and in terms of like dead characters who have this huge on stage or on screen, on page presence. That it feels like this is a really hugely populated world, even though some of these characters, like one of them, a minor character, we don't learn his name until he's almost like until the end of the whole story. So yes, yes, there are a bunch of like really well-developed minor characters, but there are the main, like the five main characters are pretty well-defined, I would say.
So what's the premise here? There's been a murder. There's characters doing wacky different storylines.
Just wacky.
Well, okay. So just wild. Let me take a crack at this. Okay.
This, because I think this is tough. This is a tough question.
It is.
What is the book about?
In 30 seconds or less. Okay. So this superhero is murdered in New York. And his old partners, calling them friends is, I think, too far of a stretch. They gradually learn why he died, and they discover a fiendish plot to save the world or ruin the world, depending on your perspective. And along the way, there's all of these other things which are taking place in these characters' lives. So it's not just like kind of a straightforward, you know, who done it? Like, let's race to the end and find out the big bad murderer. Like, we see these characters go through a bunch of complex changes. Mm. Each and every one of the main characters kind of has to cope with changes to their world. And over all of it is the looming threat of nuclear war. So this is published in 1986, 1987, right towards the end of the Cold War. And the threat of sort of mutually assured destruction, the bombs flying, is ever present. And in this story, in this fiction, Richard Nixon stayed president and is now president. And there's just a general sense that as the story develops, little clues are dropped in that we are moving towards nuclear war.
Right, right. Well, little clues and overt symbolism is dropped in that we are moving towards nuclear war.
And then there's that one line where they're like, I think we're moving towards nuclear war.
What's that on the horizon? It's nuclear war. Is that an atom bomb?
No, I mean, there are hostilities, you know, troops massing along various borders and these kinds of things, invasions. So, yes.
So, Nick, one of the things that I think is interesting about this, and I don't know if you would have picked this up by watching the Zack Snyder movie, but one of the things that's cool is the superheroes in this
book. I'd like to hear that as an insult. Whether you meant it or not, I'm going to hear it as an insult to that, that movie.
I wonder.
Fine achievement of cinematic glory.
The superheroes in this book, Nick, aren't actually superheroes. Like, with the exception of Dr. Manhattan, who is Dr. Ian Blue Dong, of course, they do not have... they don't have superpowers. They are all vigilantes. They're all guys that put on costumes at night. Some of them have technology, and some of them have, like, some kind of, like, surprising... like human abilities, but none of them have extra human abilities.
Aren't they all really strong?
Yeah. So I fear that you would maybe think that watching the films, but the way they're presented in the comics is they don't particularly have prowess that is outside of the realm of human possibility.
They're not meta humans.
Okay. Because they really punch hard in that movie.
Yeah. Like there's a scene in the movie where Night Owl and the Silk Spectre. Is that her name in this book? The Silk Spectre? The
Black Widow.
Yes.
Sorry, we can't say that. Just bleep that out.
All right.
just bleep that out.
Where they break into a prison, right? And there's this scene in the movie where they just like back to back fight, like tear through this prison. That does not really exist in the book.
Nope.
There is they break their friend out of prison in the book, but it is a very quiet affair. Like, they don't fight their way through.
So I have a couple movie theater memories in my life that will that I will always remember. One of them is Borat. Just the movie theater experience when that came out, that was just really jarring. but the other one was
I want to hear the story of that in the style of Nick's
Borat impression story. Well, in honor of the sequel of Borat, I'm going to do the rest of this episode not in his voice. So
you're just going to do the rest of the episode.
Yeah, I'm just going to do the rest of the episode. the other one was in this movie. So there's one particular scene with, I'm going to say it like Rorschach, not Rorschach. Yep. How did you say it, Joe?
I said Rorschach. Rorschach? I don't know how to say it.
You're making the A long. It's good. It's Rorschach.
Rorschach. Like a lion.
Rorschach. Like a lion and a little house. Rorschach.
Yep. Don't, careful. Don't say it three times.
Oh, you do not want to summon Rorschach.
You don't want to see that coming. So there's a scene in which, what is it now? He like leaves a saw for a guy.
Yep.
And so there's a, now refresh my memory on the scene. There's a guy handcuffed.
Yep.
And it, like the house is burning.
Yep.
Yep.
And he's like, doesn't like this guy, obviously. And he like comes into the house, but then he just has to talk to him or some bullshit. Doesn't matter what the scene is about. And, but he has a saw. He happens to have like a saw on him. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Sounds about right.
Some sort of saw to, and he kind of leaves it behind like, well, if you want to get out of this burning house, you better cut your fucking arm off because it's the only way you're getting out, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. So that's the graphic novel, and it's like this pretty badass scene.
Yeah.
And then in the movie, that doesn't happen at all. What does he do? Does he kill the guy?
I think so. I think he just kills him.
Like he doesn't that, but they still film the whole scene and they completely remove like the whole really, you know, pretty violent aspect of it. They just take that out and I think he just kills him or lets him burn and leaves or whatever.
Right. Pretty violent, but also pretty awesome.
That movie theater erupted in the loudest fucking boos I've ever heard in my life.
No. Really?
It was opening night for the movie, I think.
Had
it must
be
have
opening
been.
Night with fans like that.
And all the comic book friends were out and they just tore that movie up. And everything after that scene was met with like laughter and more booing on occasion.
Derision. Yeah,
just they were like, fuck you.
Well, that's so interesting.
This has been called, and this has been called over and over again as a novel that is a comic that's unfilmable.
Yeah.
Right? Like they say like this cannot exist in any form besides comic book. And I think that's pretty true. Like when you read this as a comic, there's so much that Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons do.
Listen, I'm going to try and keep him away from the microphone, but this is getting tiring, okay? You guys got to be responsible with your summoning of Dave Gibbons, okay? No, not you. Go away.
There's
no,
so
stop.
Much
that, down.
That they do in here, down. Though, that could only happen in a comic book, right? Like it is a story adapted perfectly, or not a story made for the medium.
Yeah, I think it's really strange because Snyder thought so hard that he was doing this film, this novel justice, this comic justice.
Yeah. We don't have to rip on him.
No, I'm not. I'm fascinated by
Ian,
it.
Ian, just leave him alone. You've been ripping on him all episode. And he did his best, guys. Okay?
He did
it's
his best. Unfortunately, his best was not very good.
It wasn't as good as the comic book or the book, as so many people would say. It was fine. Let's just move on.
Yes, it was fine. Just move on.
Hold on, I have a 1-star review. It was fine, just move on. Oh, wait, sorry, that's my review. No, I will say this. I am looking at 1-star reviews, and I'm not going to read any, but I just want to share some advice here, people. Look, if you're going to leave a review, at least leave it on the right product. Don't go to the Watchmen book and leave a 1-star review about how you hated the movie or hated the show. Okay, respect the medium. Respect that the internet is watching.
You don't want to show up on a comedy show that's mocking you for doing a wrong.
Which comedy show is that?
I was going to say Tosh.0, but I think they're over now. And also canceled, that's the worst show and nobody wants it. So
Tosh, it's pretty good. All right, let's move on.
Pretty good. Let's move on. Do you guys know the word abattoir?
I don't.
Are you trying to say avatar?
Yes, I'm mispronouncing avatar.
You were genuinely asking if we knew the word.
You guys know this word, avatar? It's James Cameron's movie about blue aliens and stuff. No, the word is abattoir, A-B-A-T-T-O-I-R, and it means a slaughterhouse for cows.
Yikes. Wow.
And
Joe, you should know that you grew up on a cow farm. I've never heard that
word before in my life. It sounds like a French slaughterhouse for cows, to be fair.
It's actually, it's from the French. The origin of the French, the origin of the word is from the French. But this is kind of famously Rorschach, or Rorschach, if you're Joe, he has this, a lot of the, a good chunk of this story is written either as his, not as his diary, or, you know, him narrating what's going on. And he's got the, he's got this very distinctive voice, which is cool because it's always awesome in a piece of literature when a recognizable character has a recognizable voice. A lot of the time this is really effective, but sometimes Alan Moore went a little bit over the top. And so this is one of the most, this is why I bring up the word abattoir. Alan Moore writes the following line as part of Rorschach's dialogue. Soon it will be dark. Beneath me, this awful city, it screams like an abattoir full of retarded children. And it's just kind of this cringeworthy, very purple prose type.
It's over the top. It sounds like something out of like a not just a detective novel, but like a really cheesy, like pulpy detective novel. Yeah.
A seriously flawed character.
trying so hard to be edgy. And
why take an entire book to tell you a character is seriously flawed? Why not just have an opening line like that? Get to the point. Needless words. So we've discussed almost nothing about this book. What's your favorite part about this book?
My favorite part about this book, Nick, is that I read this probably when I was 20 years old for the first time. And there is a page in this novel, in this comic, that I've been thinking about for 15 years at this point. Nice. This is a story that is made for this medium. Like, this is a story that exists as a comic, and it's perfect for a comic. One of the conceits of Dr. Manhattan is that he can view all of time, not just that he can view all of time at once, but he has to view all of time at once. So for him, his entire life, everything that he's ever observed and everything that he ever will observe exists at once, which is something that you couldn't do if you were, for example, writing a novel,
Batman,
or showing a movie, right? Like, you couldn't, like, because like those things exist linearly. However,
linearly.
Nice job, guys. You really get that. I didn't need to step in at all.
If you have a comic book, though, and you have this series of panels that exist in a spread across two pages, you can show all these different moments in time in that. And there's I think the most memorable book from here, where Dr. Manhattan is telling his story, and he tells it in a lot of ways out of order, but he starts to make connections between like these different moments of his life that I couldn't exist in another format.
I think the novel does really good stuff with this, making it so it's not just he's all knowing and that's the end of it. There's a really, really good device to make it so that he doesn't actually know how things end. But this is, I think I would agree, Joe, this is perhaps one of the most remarkable elements of this book is how it positions this character who has these near omnipotent superpowers as human, despite his separation from humanity. He goes through this, he has this dreadful accident and gives him these abilities. And instead of it making him less human, I think he expresses human concerns that all of us may have felt, but never to this extent. And it's just, it works really well to, in unexpected ways.
Yeah, unexpected ways.
Here's a fun fact. Did you guys know that Dave Gibbons' font that he used in Watchmen, that he wrote Watchmen in, helped inspire Comic Sans?
Oh,
that's
no,
a great,
I didn't know
that. That's great trivia. Yeah. Now, inspire as in like it is Comic Sans? I can't picture it.
It's Comic Sans like. Apparently, when the person who designed Comic Sans in 1993, 94.
Comic Sans.
Yeah, Mr. Sands.
Mr. Sands, yes.
Mr. Sands and Mr. and Mrs. Sands together got together and made this this font. This was the lettering in this graphic novel / comic was the one of I think two or three inspirations. So letter forms and appearance and all that kind of stuff.
I didn't know Comic Sans was that new. I thought it was more of like a iconic font that's been around for decades.
Well, from the 90s, you know.
I mean, that is decades now. It's close on 30 years. So.
Although I really do love the idea of like a typesetter's case, like they're setting their newspaper and it's just full of upper and lowercase Comic Sans.
Oh, that's good. Can I talk to you guys about sequels and so forth? Okay, so just there have been a lot, and I want to kind of like skate over the top of them. Apparently, when Moore and Dave Gibbons finished this, they were open to doing a sequel or more stories related to this. It didn't end up happening, and they both kind of went their separate ways. But there has been, after around the time the film came out, there was a prequel comic series which met with mixed reviews. So a prequel comic series focused on a lot of the big characters from the story, like it was called Before Watchmen. And then after that, in the 20-teens, I think, there was this sequel. It's called a maxi series, which is like a limited run, basically. And this came out to positive reviews, and it looped Watchmen into the DC universe. So Batman and Superman are involved in like Watchmen stuff. Mm-hmm. Like Batman, or Superman and Dr. Manhattan talk to each other and so forth. Wow. And the really interesting thing about this to me is that Watchmen as a story feels so complete. Mm. And it feels like it works really well. And it's also doing this explicit questioning of the superhero genre and what does this, like, it's so violent, it's so absolutist, and what is it doing to our culture to have these superheroes? And I think it's just mind-blowing how the book Watchmen is making this deconstructive effort to say, maybe we shouldn't be so wrapped up in superheroes. Maybe they're like, it's a bad idea for cultures to be invested. And what happened to this novel? It became one of the touchstones in the superhero genre. So it kind of got wrapped into the thing that it was trying to question. It's like trying to take down the man, trying to deconstruct this monolith. And what happened to it was that people started sequelizing it. People started making video games. There's a Watchmen video game. And then there was obviously the movie, and there's a TV show. The book emerges in the 1980s, which is a time for questioning of the superhero tradition, the superhero convention. So I'm not super up on my comics history, but there was a golden age and there was a silver age. And then things kind of like during the 1980s, especially, they got really real about maybe we've just been assuming too much about the positive value of, like, morally, like, what does it mean for our idea of justice to be a man in a suit goes and punches criminals until they stop, like that well, moral question, like,
bash them good.
Hey,
and one of the great things about Watchmen is like the characters in Watchmen are the ones asking those questions. Like, you have these retired superheroes who have essentially hung up their capes once they realize, hey, I've been going out at night punching bad guys and the world's not a better place for it. In fact, on the meta scale, right, Ian references earlier, like this march towards doomsday, on the meta scale, people are in more danger than ever before, right? And it has nothing, and me punching bad guys doesn't do anything.
Watchmen imagines a world after superheroes. And I think in our world today, we see crisis after crisis after crisis. We see, you know, like dreadful things happening, horrible things happening all around us. And I think humanity wants their to be superheroes. You know, we want people to be able to solve our problems with the snap of a finger. And I think it's really important to realize that the superhero, human beings are not superheroes. Superheroes don't exist. And so this book imagines a world after superheroes, and it shows us how right actions, moral actions by human beings making the right choices, that's a better route than hoping for someone to swoop in and save the day. And not to get all political here, but this is something you see with elections. People vote for the person that they think is going to swoop in and save the day. And right. I've been around long enough to realize that human beings, no matter how great they are, no matter how like well you elect them and how perfectly they seem to fit your desires, like
No matter who wins.
What are you trying to say, Ian?
No matter who wins, they're still going to screw up.
Is everything going to be okay?
Everything's going to be fine.
Everything is going to be okay. That's my rambling closing argument.
Yeah, I love it.
I think the winner today is, there's no winner today, but if I had to choose one, I would probably pick the ghost of Dave Gibbons.
Dave Gibbons is alive, I would like to point out.
Alive and well and crouched in the corner of my studio.
Rest
shivering.
Rest in peace, Dave. We miss you so much, Dave.
No, stop it.
Who wants to read a quote?
Ian, what quote did you bring? Because it's kind of a hard thing to quote.
It is. I've got the quote from end of chapter 4, where he's talking about the thermodynamic miracle.
Awesome. Cool. I brought the Percy Shelley poem, Ozymandias.
Oh, heck. Do that. It's so good. It's really hard. Just to clarify this thing. It's really hard to read
a graphic novel.
It's really hard. I mean, okay. And Moore is a really good prose writer, and he writes some really beautiful lines here, but so much of this novel is caught up in like color and the shape of the page and the placement of things and callbacks. Yeah. So with no further ado, but with a lot further aplomb, Joe Holshue, can you read us Percy Shelley's poem, Ozymandias?
So Nick, have you heard the name Ozymandias before?
Yeah, early in this episode you said it.
Yeah, so I think it's famous for a couple of different reasons. Like, I know Ozymandias from exactly three contexts. The first context is
Let's
this.
Count them down. context number one.
These
the
are
first context
that we know
is
all three.
Yes, is the former watchman Ozymandias from the graphic novel.
Okay, that's a bit of a cop out.
Yep, that's number one.
Number two.
Number two is that Ozymandias is the title of the highest rated television episode of all time.
This is
good.
This is something. The episode of Breaking Bad in the final season in which basically Walt's world falls apart is titled Ozymandias, and it is the only title on IMDb with a perfect 10 rating. And the third way that I know Ozymandias is from this Percy Shelley poem. And both of those, both the Watchmen character and the Breaking Bad episode, take their title from this Percy Shelley poem. And Percy Shelley, in a kind of a literary duel with his friend Horace Smith, challenged each other to write a sonnet about a recent discovery in Egypt. And this was the discovery of essentially the ruins of the estates, the ruins of like the monuments of Ramses II, whose Greek name was Ozymandias. Percy Shelley wrote a poem essentially about Ozymandias, Ramses II, looking around at everything he'd created and essentially being proud of it and saying like, look, my works are going to go on forever, with a central irony of there's nothing around when we find them. So with that said,
have
a sonnet.
Hold on. I'm a little confused. I understood the Breaking Bad reference. Why did you pick this?
So this is also the namesake for our villain in Watchmen. Our villain Ozymandias. Our villain/hero is Ozymandias.
Yep. Gotcha.
Who is of course like creating this world of his own.
And he's got this whole like Egyptian gimmick that's his. He's a very white dude who has just appropriated the whole Egyptian aesthetic. And it works in thematic ways. I just want to, before you go, Joe, I just want to mention that the other poem that was written, the other side of this poem is an epic poem. One of my favorite poems of all time. The other poem is trash. It's so bad.
I always feel bad when I look this up because like I can never even remember like who the other poet is or like what the other poem's about. And I have both on the page in front of me right now because I was able to I dig up the other one. But I read it and I'm like, oh yeah, I'm not gonna read that. Yeah, I'm just gonna read the good one. So Percy Shelley, Ozymandias. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal, these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty in despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away.
Nothing ever ends. Thank you.